Thanks for downloading from WRTI. This is Jim Cotter. For more information on this and all the other programming you hear on the station, go to our website, wrti.org. While you're there, you might consider becoming a member, renewing your membership, or making an additional gift. This podcast and all of the programming you hear on WRTI is made possible by our listener members. Why not become one now? Thanks, and enjoy the show. Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Frank Chavez, Artistic Director of River North Chicago Dance Company. The company is performing in Philadelphia this week as part of a tour celebrating its 20th anniversary season. David Patrick Stearns reviews the latest recording by Time for Three and speaks with the group. In the second part of a companion series to a new book called Wicked Philadelphia, Tom Keels tells the story of the little-remembered 19th century novelist George Lepard. And Susan Lewis considers the nature of video art as the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia opens an exhibition exploring animation. It's the second of a three-part, year-long examination of this modern medium. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
River North Dance Company of Chicago is celebrating its 20th anniversary this season. Since its founding in 1989, it has grown from a vibrant local company to a leading light of the dance scene in its native Windy City. It's also a preeminent national and overseas touring company, and in recent seasons has often spent more time on the road than at home. The company is rooted in the jazz dance tradition, but over the years has developed its own distinctive style that choreographs works not just to jazz, but to an array of diverse musical styles from around the world. The River North Company is in Philadelphia this week for a series of performances at the Annenberg Center in West Philadelphia, the last of which is tonight. I met with the company's artistic director, Frank Chavez, earlier this week.
We started very much as a 100% purebred jazz company, and I would say we've evolved into what I consider to be a jazz-based contemporary company. If you take the history of jazz has always been something that is based on the human experience, and it's always affected by what's going on in society, in politics, in fashion, in music. So as an American art form, it's very interesting that it progresses and it changes through the decades, with as reflected by those things I just mentioned, versus ballet, that's a traditionally 300 or 400 years old, or folk dancing, that the steps stay the same. You know, and there is that concept that a lot of, when you hear jazz company, you think it's automatically jazz music, which is not always the case. And I think that some do use jazz music, and I've used jazz music, and I love jazz music, but I just love the scope of all kinds of music. And for me, it's always been very, very important to consider my audience and to consider what they're going to like and to consider what they will be able to relate to.
How many dancers are in the company, and where do you draw from? You're a national touring company. Are your dancers coming from all over the country?
Yes, they're coming from all over the country, and actually we also have some dancers, or we've had dancers from other parts of the world as well.
What makes a River North dancer?
The company members that are, you know, have been in the company for a while, or anybody who's gone through the audition process of our normal audition, it's like a marathon. And that happens because it's very difficult to actually find a dancer that is absolutely perfectly ripe and ready to step into our repertoire. We do so many different things. We do so many different styles. It's very eclectic. It's very diverse. It is a challenge. It is quite a challenge. For a River North performance, you'll see anywhere from 6 to 10 pieces in one evening. So it moves along at a really nice pace. And this, I find, has been something that really keeps dancers very engaged and invested in the company, feeds them, challenges them. We are 13 dancers. They all dance a lot. They kill themselves just about every night. So finding those dancers becomes, again, very challenging, and to develop them, see them with a company, get them into the style of River North. And I love that River North actually has its own unique style in terms of the way we move and the way we present ourselves and how we perform.
And what is it? I mean, what is it that would suggest immediately that it is of your company?
To me, the real kind of two signatures are how lyrical the upper body is, what in ballet terms will be the épaulement or the port de bras that we do, and how we do it. And then also, I think one thing that is quite unique about River North is that we love to break down what I consider to be that fourth wall that separates the artists on stage from the audience. And that's in how we perform and how we reach across, and that we are very open and vulnerable in our performances. And that has become a trademark. People seem to really connect, and they are able to connect. There's nothing there stopping them. So there's a great feed of energy from the dancers on stage into the audience, and then it gets tossed back to the dancers. And that aesthetic, it's really more of an aesthetic, is what I have always wanted to maintain in the company throughout its 20 years. And I think it's working.
How in particular is that aesthetic common to all of the pieces that you're performing here in Philadelphia?
It's kind of touching back on the ideas of reaching across to the audience, the fact that the company has its own style. A lot of companies, you know, will have something that they can call their own style. Because the fact that I still teach the company, and we do a cross between contemporary classes or jazz classes and ballet classes for the company as their company classes, the idea that I still teach and train them all in a certain way of moving creates this style. And I'm ecstatic about the program we're doing here in Philly, and it's a brand new program since the last time we were here. And there's a lot of, you know, there's going to be touches of things that people will recognize and go immediately when they first see the first piece when the show opens. Those of our Philly audience that have seen the programs before will go like, oh yes, I'm seeing River North. And as we move into and go through the program, they'll start seeing a lot of new things and a lot of different flavors and new ideas, new pieces. But I think throughout the whole program, they'll still be able to go like, this is River North, which I love.
River North Dance Company of Chicago's artistic director, Frank Chavez. The company's final performance in a week-long engagement in Philadelphia is at the Zellerbach Theater at the Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts of the University of Pennsylvania this evening at 8.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The new album by the Philadelphia string trio, Time for Three, had a gestation period that could be compared to an elephant pregnancy, times two. Though playing popular bluegrass fusion music might at first seem easy to these classically trained graduates of the Curtis Institute of Music, 4 years of trial and error went into the making of this new disc, Three Fervent Travelers, which is released later this month. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns discovered a number of reasons for this while visiting the group after 33 takes of a single key song.
The recording world is full of stories about the performance that got away. That ultimate take when everything went more than right, but the microphones weren't on. So it seemed, at first, to bassist Renan Meyer, following many takes of the new album's key song, Hide and Seek, until producer Steve Hackman told them the tapes were indeed rolling.
It's fun. It's cool that you have to go 32 takes to get it right, and then play it, you know, for a video shoot for the 33rd take when they're not recording and feel like that was the best one.
So if the video take was the best, how do you live with that?
You just do. I mean, you know, it's...
You don't live with it, because we
rolled
it.
Oh, there you go.
Is there some numerological significance to 33 takes? That's how many Elvis needed to get Hound Dog right. But Elvis didn't scrap two entire albums en route the way Time for Three did over the past several years, as Nick Kendall explained at lunch recently.
We've gone through a real learning curve as to how to record us. We kept playing these shows and having these reactions, and then we're like, all right, let's get into the studio. We did the whole recording studio thing where Renan was almost in another room. Then we tried it in a church, and that didn't sound good either because our arrangements weren't up to snuff.
The more improvisatory pieces were recorded live in Davis, California. But the group came home for the more reflective stuff to the Curtis Institute's Field Concert Hall. The Imogen Heap song Hide and Seek was an obvious candidate for that. Time for Three often plays instrumental transcriptions of songs, but not often ones that are so pared down, so Spartan, so word-based. What evolved from arranger Steve Hackman was a sort of theme and variations piece with the kind of layers, textures, and fine shades of emotional ambivalence that Time for Three members are used to from the orchestral repertoire. After casually starting some 9 years ago, Time for Three's path into the world of commercial music has been fitful, with important breakthrough performances, good management, long tours, but lots of false starts on the recording front. The two previous albums were more like calling cards that were sold at concerts, but for wider commercial consumption, this group follows no easy precedent. Most obviously, there's Mark O'Connor, who made the famous Appalachian Waltz album with Yo-Yo Ma. But Time for Three reaches into numerous other genres. This, says violinist Zach Depew, is who they are, even if the group's evolution has been rather unplanned.
We're three college buddies that are creating music together in a manner that is just because it feels good and it feels right. It's not based on anything of us trying to do one thing or another other than let music speak for music's sake. If a Brazilian jam tune rocks and it catches us, we're going to want to create around that. If we think Beethoven would sound great with just the three of us, somehow a beautiful melody or something, we'll do that. It's like, it really stems from I've always genuinely felt it's been from an organic process for us, and not to prove a point ever.
Because Time for Three isn't the only thing these musicians have going, Depew is concertmaster of the Indianapolis Symphony and Kendall plays in the Dryden String Quartet, they aren't about to take just any recording deal, and major labels drive hard bargains these days.
We've been through situations like this is... We get to such a point where everybody's excited and we go to New York and everybody sits around that table and then we get the contract and it's just like, are you kidding me? We can't do that.
The deal with the newly reformed E1 Entertainment, previously called Koch, allows plenty of options on both sides, and Time for Three is certainly about options of all kinds. The group really sees no reason to choose between classical and pop camps. Besides solo gigs, the group has two concertos in the works by Chris Brubeck and William Bolcom, in addition to Jennifer Higdon's Concerto 4-3 that is in demand from orchestras around the country. The group also has an annual residency in Indianapolis designed to attract audiences its own age, which is early 30s. They're programming and performing happy hour concerts with lots of drinks and eclectic music, says violinist Zach Depew.
So we'll be developing repertoire and creating more of a show for us in orchestra, you know, from beginning to end. But we'd like to have a show wrapped around us, along with all the music that we love, with lighting, with the, you know, in a very tasteful way, but really creating an atmosphere based around our personalities, but not just about us.
No matter how far afield this group goes, one influence always seems to be looming in the background. The Philadelphia Orchestra. Whether they actually played in it, and Depew was a tenured member, the sound seems branded into their consciousness.
I mean, I lived in it for 9 years, and it never leaves you. It's just one of those things that you never forget. And I think all three of us have not steered far away from that. We pull the sound out. We don't press the sound out. We pull it out, which is exactly the way I feel like we were trained.
At their best, these musicians don't cross musical boundaries so much as they unite them. And bringing together the high and the low, the classical and the vernacular, is perhaps the ultimate philosophical promise of American music. But it's one that has to be renewed by every generation, and if it's to be convincing, reinvented in every piece.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Time for Three's new CD, Three Fervent Travelers, is released on January 26th. Gritty TV dramas like Law & Order pride themselves on lurid plots that are ripped from the headlines. But basing fiction on true crimes is anything but new. Now WRTI's Tom Keels explores how a Philadelphia author drew on a notorious rape and murder case to create the most scandalous bestseller of the 1840s.
In 1844, a Philadelphia writer named George Lepard published a novel called The Quaker City, or The Monks of Monk Hall. Lepard's sprawling story blended the occult, social criticism, extreme gore, and mild pornography to portray a grotesque Philadelphia that was a cesspool of vice and immorality. But LaSalle University professor Edward Pettit suggests that this fantastic novel was a disturbingly accurate vision of the real Quaker City.
The best way to describe Philadelphia then is imagine Philadelphia today and then imagine it without police. Because that's basically what you had at the time. I think there was a riot in the city, a major riot in Philadelphia every year from 1837 to 1845. Abolition halls were burned down, churches were burned down, there were a lot of anti-Catholic riots. So it's a dark, tough place to live in at the time.
Building on this bleak reality, Lepard created a novel which grows grimmer from page to page. Everyone in the Quaker City is willing to sacrifice their loved ones to achieve their own goals. At one point, a character imagines the final day of the corrupt metropolis when an earthquake plunges all Philadelphians to their deaths.
Behold the wreck of the doomed city. Temples and domes, heaps of dead and piles of solid earth mingled in one awful ruin. The river burdened with blackened corpses, and the bright sky watching smilingly over all. Look below, and with the angels of eternal justice, shout the Amen to the litany of the city's crimes. Shout, woe, woe unto Sodom!
Lepard's despairing tone may be his reaction to the crime, poverty, and chaos of his era, says James Green, librarian at the Library Company of Philadelphia.
Lepard saw the breakdown of the social order in the 1830s and 1840s in Philadelphia in terms that were very different from those we would see today. I think that he expressed much of this in this almost biblical language of outrage and prophecy, and so that's why there's an apocalyptic tone about the Quaker City. Basically, the day of judgment is at hand.
Despite this darkness, the Quaker City became the most popular novel America had ever seen, not to be outsold until Uncle Tom's Cabin nearly a decade later. James Green attributes much of Lepard's success to his leering obsession with the city's evils, punctuated by periodic sermons.
And so I think this recipe of moral outrage and dwelling on the most outrageous aspects of it, the reveling in it, I guess I would say, is a formula for success that he pretty much invented and which we still use today in all kinds of popular literature, but I would say even more in movies and television.
The Quaker City's heart of darkness is Monk Hall, a brothel where Philadelphia's male elite gathers to drink and deflower virgins. The protagonist, Arlington, accompanies his best friend, Lorimer, to Monk Hall to watch Lorimer seduce an innocent young girl. Too late, Burnwood discovers that the victim is his own sister, Mary. Insane with rage, Burnwood shoots Lorimer to death on a boat crossing the Delaware River. Ed Pettit believes that Philadelphians gobbled up this story because Lepard had simply changed the names in the biggest local scandal from the previous year.
Mallon Hutchinson Heberton met Singleton Mercer's younger sister, Sarah. I think Sarah was 16 at the time, out on the street one day, and Heberton raped her. I mean, he brought her to her house and he raped her. So she came back to the house and then she told the whole story to her mother. And then her brother, Singleton, went ballistic.
For a young girl of good family in the 19th century, the loss of virginity was a fate worse than death. Haberton refused to either marry Sarah or fight a duel with her brother Singleton, claiming they were his social inferiors. But when a drunken Singleton began to stalk his sister's rapist with a loaded pistol, Haberton decided to escape on the next ferry to Camden.
And little did he know, Singleton Mercer had hid himself on the ferry as well and came out and shot him and killed him. The resulting trial was a major event, and Mercer was acquitted, not guilty by reason of insanity, that he had gone crazy because his sister had been so dishonored, so he was not really responsible for his actions.
1 year later, The Quaker City appeared. Singleton Mercer's reaction to the book is unknown. But when Lepard attempted to mount a dramatized version at the Chestnut Street Theater, Mercer didn't hold back. He and a group of friends stormed the box office, bought 200 tickets, and threatened to burn down the theater on opening night. The play was canceled. A decade later, at age 32, George Lepard was dead, and his books soon to be forgotten.
He went on to write a dozen novels, was a major labor crusader, founded one of the first labor organizations in the country, was a crusading journalist, had his own newspapers. It's been estimated that he wrote and published 1 million words per year for 10 years. His works veered between this lurid sensationalism, but behind it all, he's trying to cure the ills of society.
Sarah Mercer would live down her public shame and marry not once, but twice, before dying in 1860 at the age of 33. But her brother's life unraveled after the publication of The Quaker City, despite his acquittal.
Singleton Mercer kind of disappears for several years, and the only mention of him is about 10 years or so later, he's in a bar brawl, and then later he's may perhaps undergo some kind of epiphany in his life, and he goes off to become a nurse to help yellow fever victims.
In August 1855, Singleton Mercer was sent to Portsmouth, Virginia, a city ravaged by the disease. Within a month, the 35-year-old volunteer died of fever himself. After moldering in a Virginia grave for 4 years, the bodies of Mercer and 8 other local volunteers were disinterred and returned to Philadelphia. Today, the acquitted murderer rests beneath a marble column in a hero's tomb at Laurel Hill Cemetery. On one side is a carving of the Good Samaritan, and the biblical quotation,
"Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends."
About 100 yards south of the yellow fever victims' monument here at Laurel Hill is a much smaller stone, almost swallowed up by the earth. It's the grave of Malan Heberton Hutchinson, moved here in 1848 when his Center City Church closed its doors. Today, only a short walk separates the final resting places of 2 young men whose shattered lives became the grist for Victorian America's most notorious novel.
WRTI's Tom Keels. His forthcoming book, Wicked Philadelphia, Sin in the City of Brotherly Love, we'll also describe the Heberton Mercer murder case and other forgotten scandals from Philadelphia's past. While drawing, painting, and sculpting have existed for centuries, the explosion of new technologies, especially in the last part of the 20th century, has given artists an array of additional media for expression. In 1975, the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia hosted a major show exploring what was then a relatively new genre, video art. Last fall, the ICA began a new, year-long exhibition of video art. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers the nature of this medium.
In video art, video refers to the medium, as in videotape or digital video, rather than the more traditional moving image medium of film. It can be an installation in which one or more videos are projected to create an environment or are part of a multimedia presentation, or be presented with a single channel, like the works in the ICA show, where a moving image is projected onto a screen or wall. It's classified as art because, unlike a videotaped TV show or conventional movie, it's more a form of artistic expression than an attempt to entertain. And it's a bit about marketing. Filmmaker Jim Finn uses a video art distributor because the field of video art is not burdened with categories.
Within the concept of film, you can really only understand my films as like, okay, it's a false documentary, or it's perhaps a fictional film, or perhaps it's a mockumentary. Whereas in video art, it's much more open to different kinds of interpretation, and you're not bound by these rules that have been rigidly applied to film over the last 75 or 100 years. That came out of essentially reasons to sell the film. You had to sell an hour and a half film.
Untethered by those rules, video artists may reject conventional cinematic techniques such as actors, narrative, or plot.
Kate Craxon curated the first part of the ICA show, which explored documentary video art. She says the artists pick and choose among conventional techniques as they pursue their artistic vision.
They're borrowing what they want from what we consider the documentary genre and documentary cinema. There's voiceovers, archival footage, there's reenactments. It's taking bits and pieces of the history of documentary film.
And so while some audiences might think of documentary as the recording of things that have actually happened,
this line between fact and fiction doesn't really exist for a lot of artists and for a lot of scholars of documentary cinema. I think that that issue has been contested for almost 100 years, this idea of depicting the real or reality or the truth on film and cinema.
An example from part one is Jim Finn's piece called Intercosmos. Finn mixes archival footage, actors, and voiceovers to tell his story, a false documentary about a real space agency set in Soviet-controlled East Germany in the 1970s. Just as the documentary form can move beyond actual factual events, the form of animation is not just about fantasy or special effects. In part two of the ICA show, curatorial fellow Lucy Gallen is presenting works of video animation or video influenced by animation techniques.
Animation is something that young artists are often turning to as a way to deal with a number of issues. Political issues, identity issues, any kind of issue can be dealt with in this medium, and it might be a particularly rich medium because it has these certain connotations of fantasy, so then you can kind of push against that.
The first of 10 works to be shown over 10 weeks is a work by Rob Carter called Metropolis, about the birth and growth of the city of Charlotte. A paper model bends, folds, crumples, and grows, showing buildings going up and coming down, complete with audio effects reflecting nature, sounds of the city, art, and art being made.
He uses cut paper, collaged paper on top of one another, actual views of the city from above, mixed with found printed material, and puts that together in a stop-motion animation.
Stop-motion animation, where objects are moved incrementally and photographed sequentially to create the illusion of movement, is just one of a range of animation techniques and influences illustrated by this show, says Gallen.
There's 10 very different ways of working, ranging from some kind of digital animation to painting that's then been turned into an animation video, but also photography. There's all of these different ways of referencing parts of our lives.
Part three of the ICA show, organized by curator Janelle Porter, will explore video art that uses concepts of humor and the absurd. ICA director Claudia Gould says this kind of expansive exhibition provides a forum for a wide range of artistic expression.
A lot of artists can fit into these themes. It's also a way for the younger curators. What's really nice is that they get to have part of their vision shown here.
And no matter what the topic, Kate Craxon suggests that the venue of a gallery, instead of a cinema, provides more choices to the artist.
There is certainly a lot more freedom within the gallery context for artists to break away from, you know, the necessity of narrative or even the installation issues. A lot of artists are very specific about how they want their work installed, how high up from the floor that's to be projected.
A gallery showing also gives more freedom to the audience, allowing visitors to spend a minute or as long as the film runs considering the work. But to fully appreciate a work of video art,
you have to spend more time because it's not like walking by a painting.
Curators and the artists as well are hoping that a viewer comes in and watches the entire piece.
I think the best way to see it is from the beginning to the end.
The works in the current show range from about 1.5 to 28.5 minutes. Part two of Video Art Replay, called Everyday Imaginary, is now at the Institute of Contemporary Art in West Philadelphia through March 21st. The year-long exhibition concludes with a show opening in April, which examines video art that uses humor and the absurd.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony in C under their music director, Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan, our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.